You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. So, from 13 million years ago in Spain, where do we go from there? Well, how about even further back? Going further back isn't as simple as following a straight line trail, as we heard in the last segment. There are also lots of false leads, and at times it's hard to see really where the trail, winds. It goes. Where does it go? So we need a good guide. And joining me now is Richard Dawkins. He's a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University in the UK, author of many books I'm sure you're familiar with, including The Selfish Gene. His new book is The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution, and it's just out in bookstores now, and he's going to lead us backwards along that path of evolution. He joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Dawkins.
Hello, thank you.
Did you pay attention at all? Were you able to hear some of that conversation we had?
I certainly did. I was very interested in that.
What strikes you about these findings that keep coming up?
I agreed entirely with the speaker about not being surprised that this fossil is found in Eurasia rather than in Africa. In my new book, The Ancestor's Tale, the orangutan's tale is about this very matter of where our ancestors were before they came into Africa. And I take the view that they were indeed in Eurasia at about that time, and then they went into Africa to give rise to the African apes, including ourselves.
And as I said before, it seems like the more fossils we discover, we find out how much further spread out these creatures were.
Yes, that's no surprise. I think everybody is increasingly realizing that now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your book. What was the impetus? This actually goes backwards. We start present day and we go backwards. Why did you choose that method?
If you go forwards, and I wanted to write a complete history of life from the origin, which is about 4 billion years ago until today. If you go forwards, if you end up with humans, as it's very tempting to do, because after all we are humans and we're interested in humans, if you start at the beginning and end up with humans, it looks as though evolution was always aimed at humans. And a lot of people think it was, which is a kind of vanity, and of course it wasn't. So I didn't want to give that impression. But if you start at the end, if you start now in the present and go back to the beginning, then it doesn't matter where you start. You could start with a horse, or you could start with an earthworm, or you could start with a human. Wherever you start, if you go backwards and trace your ancestry backwards, then you're going to get to the same point. That's what I do, and that's my excuse, really, for starting with humans and doing it from a human point of view. It is a human pilgrimage. It's a pilgrimage by us humans to discover our ancestors, first of all our recent ancestors, those just in the last 100,000 years, the last million years, the last 5, 6, 7 million years, etc., back to the origin of life. As we human pilgrims go back, we are joined successively by other pilgrims. The first ones to join us are the chimpanzee pilgrims, and as we've just heard, the rendezvous, as I've called it, rendezvous one with chimpanzees, is something like 5, 6, or 7 million years into the past. Rendezvous two is with the gorilla pilgrims. They're the next ones that we greet as we go into our backward journey. Then the orangutan pilgrims, then the gibbon pilgrims, then the old world monkeys, and so on, back through 39, there are only 39 of these rendezvous points, until we hit number 39, which is where we meet the bacteria. Mm-hmm. Then we go on back to Canterbury, which is the origin of life. Canterbury, because I am loosely modelling it on the Canterbury Tales, because of the idea of the epic pilgrimage. And also modelled on the Canterbury Tales are the tales. As each of my pilgrims, whether it's the gorilla or the duck-bill platypus, whatever it is, as they join us, they have the option to tell a tale. And these tales form the bulk of the book. By the way, they're not told by the pilgrim itself, they're told in my voice. But like Chaucer's tales, they are not necessarily about the pilgrim either. The miller's tale, after all, is not about millers. Mm-hmm. My tales are about some general principle of life, some general principle of evolution. And they can be read in any order. You don't have to read the book straight through from start to finish. You can pick the tales up in any order.
Yes, and it's written in a very concise method to doing that. I'm talking with Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale. We did a program in the other hour about evolution and talking about the controversy about teaching evolution in some classrooms in America. Why do you think that Great Britain, UK, other countries don't have as big a problem with that idea? Why in this country does there seem to be such a hue and outcry in some places?
I think the difference is that although we have creationists in Britain, we don't have any in political power. Something's gone wrong with democracy in this country such that, how can I describe it, religious ignoramuses somehow managed to hijack local school boards and maybe even higher political offices. That doesn't seem to happen in Britain. I'm not quite sure why not. Perhaps we're just less obsessed with religion generally. So although creationists do exist, they don't seize political power in the way that they do in this country.
The rest of Europe feel the same way, do you feel?
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, let's talk about your travels backwards in time. And let me ask you, you talked about all the different points, the turning points. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite time in history where you would like to be alive if it weren't today?
Gosh. Well, there are so many. I mean, I suppose the time of the dinosaurs would be extremely interesting. Mm-hmm. The time of the mammal-like reptiles a bit earlier, the Cambrian explosion, although you'd have to put on a scuba kit in order to see the animals there. I think I would like to go back to, really more recently, to the origin of language, which we don't know when that was, but maybe a million years or so, and see what language was like when it was just beginning.
I always have trouble trying to get all these periods straight. I know in one of your pages you have the simplified version of the time scale by the International Commission on Stratigraphy. How do you pronounce that?
Stratigraphy.
Stratigraphy, thank you. Is there and you look there and you look and see all those names. Has anybody come up with a mnemonic device or a way to remember all of that?
Oh, gosh, yes.
There is?
That's a very good idea. I must get down to that. I'll get down to that straight away when I get out of here.
I have for the last 40 years. Yeah. I've been asking people. Yes. No one has one, you know.
Yes.
So get on that. Get right on that.
I will.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Ron in Oklahoma City. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Hi there.
I wondered if you'd comment about the idea that instead of having gradual evolution, evolution actually came in sudden, fast changes.
Yes, that's somewhat exaggerated. It's called punctuated equilibrium, at least the respectable version of it is. And all it means is that during the sudden fast changes, it's still gradual. It never is anything other than gradual, but it's so fast that it's too fast to see on the fossil record. So as you dig down through the fossils, it looks like a sudden jump, but that's only because it happened very fast or because it happened somewhere else. Often evolutionary change happens not in major land masses, but on islands in the broad sense around. So it is still gradual, and it's got to be gradual, otherwise it doesn't work. It doesn't explain the evolution of complexity and the beauty and elegance of living things. Mm-hmm. There are other ideas which are not punctuated equilibrium but often are confused with it. For example, macromutation, where a child actually is so different from its parents that it might be placed in a different species. That doesn't happen, in my view, but some people think it does, and they sometimes confuse it with punctuated equilibrium. I think that evolution is essentially always gradual, although sometimes the gradualness is so quick that it looks sudden in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
How useful do you find tracing things through genetics more useful than tracing things by the physical differences, or each has its own place, of course?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, recently, genetic tracing has really come into its own. And nowadays, because every living creature has such an enormous database of DNA sequences in it, carries around in every one of its cells, and since the sequencing of the DNA has become so quick and cheap now, it's almost reaching the point where you don't need morphology or fossils anymore in order to reconstruct the family tree of life. It hasn't quite reached that point, but it is coming to the point where any two animals or plants that you care to choose, literally any, you could compare their DNA on a detailed point-by-point, letter-by-letter basis and work out how close cousins they are and how far back in time their common ancestor, or as I call it in my book, their concestor, lived.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale. There's a fascinating chapter called The Duckbill's Tale about the platypus, one of my favorites.
Yes.
And its sensory organs.
The platypus, the duckbill's tail, is about its duck bill.
Yeah.
It looks just like the bill of a duck, but it's a much more complicated thing. It's a kind of underwater radar, or it doesn't actually beam out signals like a true radar does, but it's very sensitive to electrical signals. And as the platypus swims through the mud in the Australian rivers, it waves its head from side to side, a bit like a radar dish scanning. And what it's doing is picking up the tiny traces of electrical signals which are inadvertently given off by the animal's prey, little shrimps and things like that. And it looks as though what's happening is that there are two kinds of sense organ in the bill. There are electrical sense organs, of which there are a very large number, and there are also mechanical sense organs which are picking up waves in the water itself. And the authors of this study describe it as a thunder and lightning system.
Huh.
You know how when you hear thunder, and you see lightning and then you hear thunder,
right.
If you time the interval between the lightning and the thunder, you can work out how far away the thunderstorm is, because you know the speed of sound. Well, the suggestion of these Australian workers is that that's what the platypus is doing. The equivalent of the lightning is the electrical signals that it's picking up from its prey. The equivalent of the thunder is the mechanical waves through the water. And so by timing the difference between them, the platypus can work out how far away the shrimp or whatever it is. Of course, it doesn't consciously work it out. It doesn't consciously time it. That's all handled by automatic computer machinery in the platypus's brain.
Mm-hmm. When you go back and you do research for your book, do you find you saying to yourself how awesome the history of life
yes.
is on Earth? You know,
very much so.
That we ever got to this point? You know.
Well, yes. I mean, one of my main missions in writing this book, and indeed all my books, is to arouse that sense of awe in my readers. And this one, no less than any other. I mean, the details, the sheer complexity and the elegance, the beauty of the adaptations that all these different kinds of animals and plants have for surviving in their different ways, coupled with the knowledge that they're all fundamentally doing the same thing, which is preserving and propagating the genes that ride inside them. It really does fill one with awe.
Yeah, we spend so little amount of time and money and effort on this planet and finding out what is here. You know,
yes.
going to the rainforest or especially under the oceans, where we literally have no idea what's down there.
Well, I completely agree with you. And I think it's tragic, really, that the number of us who spend most of our time fussing about what, by comparison, are trivial, local, parochial, temporary mm-hmm. things like politics, when there's all this wonder out there that we could be out there understanding and imbibing, so that before we die, we really know why it was worth being born in the first place.
Yeah, I'm talking with Richard Dawkins, a new book, The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's see if we can get some of our listeners who'd love to talk to you. Hi, Mike in Ithaca. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Dr. Dawkins, please forgive me if I give Ira a few seconds to answer his question. It's camels ordinarily sit down carefully, perhaps their joints creak, perhaps early oiling might prevent permanent rheumatism.
That's the mnemonic.
Will you send that to
yes.
me? Will you send that to me?
Go to the British Museum of Natural History and ask to speak to Bill Dolling. He's a beetle expert.
I will.
I learned it from
I
him.
Will do.
We'll put it
I
on our web. We'll get it transcribed. Just put it on our website. Anybody wants to take a
lovely.
Look at it.
Lovely. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Dawkins, you are a great man, and I love you, but I'm going to ask you a difficult question because I think if anyone can answer it, you can.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Now the other shoe's going to drop.
No. I believe there is an answer. I just don't know it yet. But I would like somehow an explanation how the bat wing isn't irreducibly complex. Because when the bat is on the ground using it as a terrestrial locomotion organ rather than as a wing, it's necessary that the segments of his digits match the lengths of the segments of his arm so that the joint, elbow joint, is in just the right place. And it's, and a miss is as good as a mile, so it isn't something that could be approached gradually. And I want to know why it isn't irreducibly complex, because if I believe in evolution, I have to say it isn't irreducibly complex, but I can't see how.
Yeah, obviously, I'd have to look at that case in detail. It's not one that's been brought to my attention.
I hope you forgive me for asking you that.
Of course. I mean, it sounds very, very interesting. As you very well know, it's not a good way to argue to pick a particular case and say, because I cannot think of a brain which it could have evolved gradually.
But it's fun.
It is fun. But what we must beware of is giving people the impression that if we, in our lack of ingenuity, fail to think of something, that therefore there isn't an answer, because perhaps we haven't thought about it long enough. And I certainly haven't, because I've only just started.
That's exactly true. You know, all the answers you gave on air today are the ones I would have given.
All right, thanks for calling.
Very good. But I will look that up. It's a very interesting one to think about.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go quickly to Amy in St. Louis. Hi, Amy.
Oh, hi there, Ira. And I'm so glad to hear Dr. Dawkins. Again, I love you, too. From geology class, we learned the periods of the Paleozoic. Can Oscar see down my pants pockets? Okay, so Cambrian Ordovician, you know, et cetera.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, since there are only three periods in the Mesozoic, you know, get over it, just learn them.
Yes.
And the epochs of the Tertiary are Pal, Ernie, Owes Me Plenty for the Paleozoic Oligocene,
I wish I had a bit of paper to write these down.
Well, we'll get it for you.
Okay.
Go ahead. Did you have another one, Amy?
No, I thought that was enough for today.
That was pretty
good. What I got from the show today was religious ignoramuses. I will use that often, and I wish I had the opportunity last week. I had an opportunity to use that for someone that was giving me a hard time, who believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. So thank you again, Dr. Dawkins, for helping us all out.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
And Charles will, by next week sometime, we'll have all these transcribed. Maybe we'll have a little section, and we'll ask you, you listeners out there, to send us more stuff. I mean, even before today is over, I'm sure we're going to get more mnemonic devices in. And that page that you have on your book is the longest, wonderful graph I've ever seen of all the subdivisions there. That would take, I think, a novel to write the words down for that in a mnemonic device.
Yes.
We're talking with Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Evolution of to the Dawn of Evolution, just out from Houghton Mifflin. He's in a studio in Los Angeles. We're going to take a break, come back, and let you question and puzzle Dr. Dawkins some more. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about evolution with my guest Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. And our number is 1-800-989-8255. This book is really well written in all different kinds of ways, but it has nice little chunks of information, the kind of way I like to write stuff. And if you just want to sit down for a little bit of time, you can just take out a little chunk and save it for the next time. It's terrific that way, Dr. Dawkins.
Thank you.
Yeah. And there's one section, Rendezvous 37, that's entitled Uncertain. What do you mean by uncertain in this one?
Well, I think that's one of the virtues of science, is that we know when we're uncertain and we admit it. But on the other hand, we say we're working on it. So this was a point. All the other 39 rendezvous, we have a pretty good idea who it is that's joining us.
Right.
In this particular case, there's still a lot of work to be done, and so I just didn't know what order to put these particular creatures in. And so I came right out and said I was uncertain.
Yeah, that's good, because, you know, that's what science is all about, finding the new stuff. There's also a section on, in this bacteria section, on archaebacteria. And do you think, you know, this was a great discovery, because we get to know how bulletproof some of these microbes are in the Earth. Do you think there are still more of these undiscovered deep down, you know, in the vents and other places, other forms of life that we haven't figured out yet or have no
idea. I think there are, and the deep smokers in the ocean were a huge surprise when they were discovered, and I think there probably are as more to come. I believe that Craig Venter, the great molecular biologist, has a project at the moment in which he's simply taking up samples of water from the sea and analyzing them for DNA, not looking for organisms at all, but just looking directly for DNA, and is picking up, I think, hundreds of new species just simply by doing that, not really even knowing what they are, but just picking up and finding them in the sea. That's a very, very exciting and original approach.
Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. 1-800-989-8255. Gary in St. Louis. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. This is a rather difficult question, too, for Dr. Dawkins, but I was a biology major and a physician, but I never did understand this as I went through school. In the thermodynamic principles, systems tend to become chaotic and not organize themselves, and life is really a process of extreme organization and constantly increasing organization. How does that line up with the processes of thermodynamics? And a more specific question is, it's very difficult for me to understand, is how I understand the whole process of DNA using RNA to produce protein, but how are those elements around so that there could be duplication so the process could be repeated enough that another cell could be formed?
Right. The second law of thermodynamics, of course, applies to a closed system. And so entropy increases, chaos increases in a closed system. If there's energy being fed in from outside, then you do not expect entropy to increase. So life is most definitely not, in any sense, a reversal of the second law of thermodynamics or a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. You should think of it as a little local pumping of the water upstream, but on the whole, the overall direction of the river is downstream.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very serious misconception, which actually, I'm sorry to say, is put about by creationist propaganda, that life or evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics. Natural selection is a supremely non-random process. It's a bit like Maxwell's demon. It's a kind of demon which is non-randomly sorting and increasing the order in life, but at the expense of the rest of the universe, so that the second law is preserved.
Mm-hmm.
The other question about where does DNA and RNA or whatever it is that replicates get its start? DNA is much too high tech a replicating molecule to have been the original one. DNA requires protein in order to work, and protein needs DNA in order to be made. So that can't be how life began. Life originally must have begun with some other self-replicating molecule, which is probably no longer with us. It could have been our RNA, and one of the suggestions that I've discussed in my chapter called Canterbury, which is, as you know, the goal of the pilgrimage, is the RNA world theory. RNA is not as good a replicating molecule as DNA is, and it's not as good an enzyme, a catalyst, as protein is, but it's sort of just about adequate in both departments. And so it could be that before we got the professional replicator, which is DNA, and the professional enzyme, which is protein, we had RNA doing a sort of botched job of both, and then that it was enough to let natural selection start. And once natural selection had been going for a bit, then the, as it were, the professionals evolved, the professional replicator being DNA, the professional enzyme being protein. That's a currently favoured suggestion, and it's one that I discuss in The Ancestor's Tale.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. I love to read about the oceans and the life in it, as you could probably tell. And one of my favorite parts of your book is Rendezvous 28, about the Nidarians, Silent Sea, as you say. And you describe them in one of your illustrations as the most complicated piece of apparatus inside any cell, a cross-section of your harpoon.
Yes. The cnidarians, that's jellyfish and sea anemones and hydras and things like that, have this extraordinary weapon, a harpoon, but it's a harpoon within a cell, so it's a cellular-level harpoon. It's the most complicated piece of apparatus, I conjecture, within one cell, and it's absolutely how you recognise a cnidarian. It's entirely a diagnostic of them, with one or two revealing exceptions, a real case of the exception that proves the rule. There are some sea slugs which have these harpoons, and the only reason they have them is that they eat them from jellyfish and then use them. They export them to their own body wall and use them as weapons. So it isn't really an exception to the rule. But otherwise, they are diagnostic of the cnidarians, and they are wonderful pieces of cellular, complicated cellular apparatus.
What's also interesting about the cnidarians and is that you talk about them, how they make islands. Islands, as you say, you can live on, islands big enough to need and accommodate an airport.
Yes.
The whole ocean is full of these graveyards, aren't they, of these
coral.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Yes, you're speaking of coral.
Right.
The structures that corals build over hundreds of years can be, I suppose, the largest structures, the largest pieces of evidence of life outside humans. It's been said that the Great Barrier Reef is visible from outer space as one of the only living structures that is. These are, as you say, graveyards of corals. The living corals are all living at the surface, and what they're living atop is the generations of their ancestors, which are compacted in the rock, which is made of dead coral below them. So these coral reefs are enormous things, huge things, and not only are they huge, they also are very complicated, and they provide a kind of reservoir for life. These are surfaces on which all kinds of other life can dwell. They're a bit like rainforests in a way. They're a kind of underwater equivalent of the Amazon rainforest in their ecological complexity.
Talking with Richard Dawkins, his latest book is The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. Let's go to Dana in Tucson. Hi, Dana.
Hello, Ira and Richard.
Hello.
I find this topic extremely fascinating, and I especially like how you compared the epic journey to the epic journey described by Geoffrey Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales. But I do take issue with your calling some Americans religious ignoramuses. I believe in God. I don't believe that creationism and evolution are necessarily incompatible. In fact, I think that both are required. And in fact, how would bacteria be created and even the mechanism of evolution be created without the deity? So I'd just like to hear your comment.
I didn't, of course, mean to say that all religious people are ignoramuses. All creationists are ignoramuses. But, of course, all religious people are not creationists. From the Pope down, sophisticated theologians all believe in evolution, as you do. And sophisticated theologians are even more annoyed about creationists than I am, because it's creationists that bring down the good name of religion.
Okay, Dana?
Thank you.
Thank you. Talking with Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution, this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato. Let's continue with lots of folks who want to talk to Richard. Chuck in San Francisco, hi. I have a question for Dr. Dawkins.
I do indeed.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been wondering about this since your show on the human genome sequencing final version came out. And I was wondering why we think why we have so few genes, basically. And I was wondering if it was because our particular adaptive strategy, technology, is so effective that we're not forced to do as much adaptation through genetic means or phenotypical means. And it also got me thinking about why there's so much junk DNA. And I guess my question is there some pattern that we can connect the amount of genetic material in a species and its particular history of adaptation? My idea being, is it is all this junk DNA and all these genes perhaps just raw material, which the more of it you have, the more material you have for mutation to take place and for new traits to emerge and therefore...
Let's get an answer.
Okay. I think it would be misleading to suggest that humans have particularly few genes. We don't have any fewer than any other mammals. We have we have roughly the same number of genes as any other mammal. Junk DNA is an interesting phenomenon, and that's DNA that isn't doing anything. And most large creatures have quite a lot of it. We have quite a lot. Some others have even more. There are some salamanders that have vastly more DNA than closely related species of salamanders. And the difference there has got to be junk, because it's not reasonable that one salamander species should need huge quantities more DNA than a closely related salamander species. So clearly a lot of it is junk, and a lot of ours is junk, which in a way makes your question even more poignant. How can we get away with so few useful genes that are actually doing something?
Yeah.
I think the way to look at it is that the mammalian genome, and it's pretty much the same in all mammals, there are just detailed differences, is rather like the toolbox of subroutines which sits inside any computer which software writers can call upon and use. So inside the computer is a set of toolbox routines that do all the things that are necessary, like pull down windows and resizing windows and all the things that every program needs to do. And when a programmer comes along and writes the software, what he does is kind of piece together calls of these different subroutines. So you call this one, you call that one, you call the other one, call the first one again, etc. Think of the genes that we sequence in the Human Genome Project as a bit like those toolbox subroutines. And there are just a few genes which are the programmers, which are actually doing the calling, actually switching this one on now, switching that one on next, switching the other one on, and switching them on in different cells of the body. So it's rather that the genes that... When one says that the human genome has only about 30,000 genes... What that means is that there are 30,000 subroutines which are called in various complicated orders, and the order of calling them is different in humans than it is in dogs, than it is in mice, etc.
Very interesting. Richard Dawkins, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us, and I wish you good luck on your new book.
Thank you very much.
You have a new one in the works?
Not
you
yet.
Take
no,
a breather after this.
Still recovering from this one. Yes,
blame you. Over 600 pages, but a very, very good and very complete and easy read. I recommend it to as a gift in the holiday season. It's terrific. Richard Dawkins, author of The Ancestor's Tale: A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. Our program is produced by Ned Heist. And Karen Vergoth is our senior producer. Charles Berquist is our web producer, and also our director. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. Our audio engineers are Mike Galick and Rico Cardi in New York. Kevin Wade is our technical director. If you missed anything we talked about, surf up to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have a Kids Connection there, free curricula that we make out of Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.